Here, we'll get started. Well, we're very fortunate today to have with us Tom Ricketts, owner of the Chicago Cubs, who trained right here, as you all know, in Mason. Tom's the chairman and a lifelong fan of the team. In 2009, he led his family's acquisition of the team from the Tribune Company. And when he and his family were introduced as new owners of the Cubs, he outlined three goals for the organization. Win a World Series, preserve and improve Wrigley Field for future generations, and be good neighbors, give back to the city and the neighborhood. Tom and his brother Pete once actually lived across from Wrigley Field. And in fact, Tom met his wife in the bleachers at Wrigley Field. And together with their sister Laura and brother Todd, the Ricketts siblings serve as the board of directors for the Cubs. Now, Tom is also the chairman and CEO of Chicago-based InCapital LLC, which he co-founded in 2000. It's a global investment bank that underwrites and distributes fixed income securities by major corporations, banks, and federal agencies. And in 2010, Tom was named Ernst & Young's Midwest Finance Entrepreneur of the Year. He also has been named to the Institutional Investor magazine's Online Finance 40, representing the nation's most influential people in e-finance 5 times in the past 8 years. And for some reason, his bio does not mention his alma mater, which I'll have to add in, which is also mine, the University of Chicago. Tom got both his undergraduate degree and graduate business degree from the University of Chicago. So we welcome him.
Great to have you. Yeah, thank you. All that stuff is actually true.
All right, that's great.
Even the wife and the
pictures. That's great. So Tom, you grew up in Omaha. So what are some of your earliest baseball memories? Did you have a favorite team growing up?
I think, you know, you think about baseball and when a lot of us were kids, first of all, we played a lot more. You're out in the yard playing, which is something that's kind of, I think we've lost a little bit of that with all the organized leagues and such. But, playing a lot, but also the Omaha Royals, AAA club of the Kansas City Royals were there, and I went to a lot of Omaha Royals games. Plus, College World Series was an Omaha thing, so that was always something we looked forward to, going out and, you know, seeing, you know, the Oklahoma State-Miami game or whatever, you know. So I had a great baseball childhood. Largely a Royals fan growing up. It's the closest, obviously the closest major league team. And then, like, the players I would associate with are the players that would come from Omaha. So I got to know a lot of, if someone asked me, put a lie detector on, who was your favorite player as a kid, I'd have to say Rupert Jones. Because he was a star in Omaha, then he got taken by the Mariners and expansion draft. But, you know, like the Jamie Quirks and the Duke Watsons and those guys that played for Omaha before they went to Kansas City.
Yeah.
Jamie's actually not a coach on the Cubs. But anyway, I always liked the Cubs as a kid. So it was a little bit more of a Royals fan.
Yeah. So when you moved to Chicago to go to college, right? In the 80s, you became fan of the Cubs more so at that point? Or did you
My first trip to Wrigley, I was a senior in high school, or my senior year of high school, and for many, many people, like, that first trip, and you're going, and the first time you walk up the ramp and you see the field, and then of course I went to college in 83, 84 was a great year for the Cubs, very successful until the very end, very successful season, and that was a very compelling team, a lot of great characters, an exciting team to cheer for. And so between, like, seeing Wrigley for the first time and falling in love with that beautiful team, it was really
cool. Let's talk a little bit about your early business career. Right out of undergrad at the University of Chicago, you became a market maker on the Chicago Board Options Exchange. So here you are in your early to mid-20s.
Out of school, I worked in the summers on the exchange, and then after school was over, I got a job on the floor, and then after a couple of years, after a short period of time, I was a trader in the pits, and then I bought out my contract to be really independent in the pits, so I was probably on my own at the age of like 25 or 26, and, And it was a great time. I mean, you can meet a lot of great people. You have a lot of fun. It's an exciting job. I wasn't that great a trader, unfortunately. So I went back to business school to be able to move on. And it's a great background. It prepares you for nothing. But it's a great way to spend your 20s. And you get a lot of time to go to baseball games,
right? You know, just fast forwarding a few years ahead, in the mid-90s, when stocks and junk bonds were all the rage, you pioneered bringing investment-grade bonds to retail investors. And much of that was through the use of the internet online. And tell us a little bit about that. And of course, you formed In Capital, which is where Capital did.
Yeah, we were in a different firm at the time and kind of came up with this concept. It was a lot of people that were just kind of ignoring investment-grade bonds. People were buying junk bonds and whatever, and people were buying stocks. It was during the technology boom in the mid to late 90s. And I think a lot of times in financial products, you know, and sometimes the right thing to do is to pick the idea that no one likes until, you know, everyone thinks it's a bad idea until it becomes a good idea again. So we got into this niche and said, okay, well, you know, why can't individuals have an easier time to buy regular bonds? Because they'd have to go buy a lot of funds, which have a lot of expenses. And anyway, so, and in order to aggregate this very disparate kind of investor community, we had to create great systems. And so by leveraging, you know, some good systems, we were able to create this new market for bond issuers like the GEs of the world and Bank of America. So we're always looking to sell bonds to new investors. And then I worked at a firm, and at the firm we worked at, there were some changes. And for anyone that's ever worked at one of these investment banks, you know that half the battle is your competitors and half the battle is your own internal politics. And at some point it became apparent that this machine we built was not going to be in our control anymore. So we quit. Started In Capital. I bought out my partner right away. And then we got back in the market, and I guess I was 33 or 34 and just kind of running the investment bank. So, and it's becoming very, very successful.
All right, you have offices now in Boca Raton and in Europe?
Yeah, we have about 140, 150 people, Chicago, Florida.
But the size of the organization is relatively small. And for that, you know, indicates that you get so much leverage out of the internet technology.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, it's very analogous to baseball to the extent that, it's a prerequisite now to have good systems. What we levered on the front end was one thing that we could do that the big competitors, the Merrills and the big guys we're competing against couldn't do, was to just really take a few million dollars and build a very specific application. And the market to them seemed too small for those kind of capital investments. Whereas for us, we saw the potential, and I was able to put aside the dollars to build the system to really focus on the products we want to focus on. So yeah, definitely leveraging technology. You got to play smart, and you got to get scale. That's what you're thinking.
So now let's fast forward ahead to that 2008-2009 timeframe when you and your family decide to make a run. What motivated you to get into that whole process? You were up against some pretty formidable groups. How did the process unfold?
Well, it was a pretty three-dimensional process, and I think it's kind of like asking my wife to describe childbirth. I mean, it was a long, painful, messy process. But we got through the. It started with the fact that. The Tribune, yeah, if anyone remembers, the Tribune was kind of struggling looking for a private equity investor at some point back in, I guess, 07 or something like that. And I just knew that a private equity firm would have a difficult time owning a baseball team. There's really no dividends, and there's very limited liquidity. You have to have a very long-term time horizon. So we didn't think that would work. And at that point, we had my father had basically, you know, set aside some funds years ago that all of us kind of, that myself and my siblings kind of managed or whatnot. I just kind of propped everybody on this concept of why don't we just, if the Cubs ever become for sale, let's just throw our hat in the ring and let's see if maybe that, you know, could be something that works for us. Because, you know, our best memories of the early days of Ameritrade, which was when it was a famous business. So to be able to have take these dollars and put them into an asset that we truly cared about. It was truly a family business and something we could all get involved with and have fun with. It seemed like an opportunity of a lifetime. Well, so we got the process started. There were a lot of other bidders, a lot more higher profile bidders on the front end. I spent about a year where everyone just said, oh, that's great, you're bidding for the Cubs. I'm so sorry these other bidders are going to get it. But we were confident in the fact that the sellers would want to take the best bid, maybe not the highest, but the best bid. We thought we could put that together. Financial markets became extremely unstable toward the end of the process, and I think that played to our advantage somewhat because we were a family, not a series of limited partners that all had to kind of hold the group together or anything like that. We're very steady, very consistent, just kind of hung with it, and ultimately through lots of ups and downs, we had markets exploding, we had banks not willing to lend, we had governor going to jail, we had everything going on during this process. So fortunately, we hung tough and got to the finish line.
And so, dollars aside, the thing that gave your group a competitive advantage was the fact that it was a family entity, or the fact that you were Chicago group.
Well, I think the most important thing was that we were just a family entity that, we're all just willing to just ride it out. And there wasn't a lot of phone calls like, are we still into this? And the markets were going nuts. So I think it would have been very difficult for another type of investment group to really hold all that together during the extreme volatility we saw from the summer of 2019.
So in your first 2.5 years, what's different from your expectations? What did you not see coming in? What surprised you?
Well, we had a lot of lead time. We had about 3 years in this process before we actually closed. That's we had a lot of time to prepare, including reading Diamond Dollars, by the way. But the so I don't think there's any big surprises per se. And there's a lot of learning curves. There's a lot to know about. How the best way to handle the players, a lot to know about how to build your system. I spent a lot of time traveling. I've been to all of our affiliates multiple times. I've been to the Dominican 3 times. Just really understanding, how the whole business works. It's not just about, which 25 guys you run out there on April 5th. It's really about what are you doing to look at the long-term perspective and build for the future. So that's been a learning curve. Engage in everything that goes on, and understand more about how things work in the league has been a learning curve. Political learning curve, dealing with, getting to know our elected officials, something I really hadn't focused on before team ownership. So there's been a lot to work on, and it's a never-ending process.
What's been the highlight or two of that 2.5 years?
Well, I think that, right now, we're probably in the best place we've been. On the front end, we made a lot of changes on the business side. Our team president, who I think does a terrific job, and myself went out and got some new people to kind of flesh out and round out a really great business organization. And then, obviously, over the past 6 months, bringing in the new leaders on the baseball side. And I think, what's often lost or kind of forgotten in discussing baseball is, I mean, that's really two sides of the same coin. You got to be good with both of those halves of your organization. And the confidence that I have in the business side now I have in the baseball side. So I think probably in our best place right now.
Let's talk a little bit about that. Probably the biggest single decision you had to make was the decision to bring in the run baseball operation and make the choice of Theo. Tell us a little bit about your thought process going into that whole really important critical decision that was going to set the trajectory of the organization for the next decade.
Yeah, no question. I mean, I honestly did feel like it was the biggest decision I'll make with the Cubs. We had about 6 weeks to end the season where it was public we were going to be looking for a new leader in baseball. And really kind of started down two parallel tracks at that point. We had a couple people who were focused specifically on quantitatively analyzing each team in player development and baseball wins, and subcategories in each of those two categories. So Ari Kaplan, who works with the Cubs, and Steve Walters, who was a consultant to me at the time, just ground out a lot of analysis. So I told him, look, I don't want to hear about names or people or anything, just analyze the organization. So that was half of it. The other half was I reached out to about 20 people in the industry, other GMs, agents, other owners, and I just talked to people about what they thought I should be focused on in terms of who should be the next leader. And you know, and then at the end of all those discussions, I said, okay, well, if those are all great points, now which of the people in the industry really would be the best fit for us? And you know, obviously, you know, Theo's name comes up a lot. I get some people are like, well, you spent 6 weeks analyzing baseball to come up with Theo as the answer. I'm like, I want to be thorough. And I didn't know if you and I didn't know if you had any interest in that. So it was an important part of the process. And then of course when the season ended, just reached out to the Red Sox, got permission to talk to him, and we met, talked for 4 or 5 hours, and was very impressed with not only his accomplishments, but his vision for the future, and super impressed with his focus on the team, not just team on the field, but team around him, and how it's a collective effort of a lot of guys working hard. So we think it was a great fit.
And it sounds like this was apparent from the very first meeting, the very first hour.
Yeah, no question. Within a few minutes of the
So how would you characterize your philosophy as a running business? Any business,
particularly? Well, I mean, in any business, I think you start off by, you know, you set the big goal. What are we here for? Why are we getting out of that? And you can layer in a few targets, some interim targets, or things we have to accomplish to earn more, or you know, goals you have, you know, targets you have to hit over a period of time. But after that, you know, you go out and you find the right person, you find the right people to lead, and then you give them all the support you can, and that's what you're running with.
You know, one of the things that's always struck me in the conversations that I've had with you is the time horizon of your approach. You seem to be very long-term. I don't know, I just get the sense from conversations, and you never said this, that you can see yourself on your own. And what is the culture like within a baseball organization? Because that seems atypical when I'm getting that. And I feel like there's a lot more short-term focus within baseball. And I wonder how that fits with your organization.
Right. Well, I mean, to be clear, we want to win immediately and always. I think what's become obvious to me over the last couple of years is that when an organization starts thinking too short-term, you end up putting yourself into the trap. And you have to be careful that your short-term decisions aren't affecting your long-term flexibility. And we've seen that firsthand. Perhaps we've seen it in other organizations. So, you know, telling the guys on the baseball side of the organization that, you know, we're going to be patient and do it the right way is a critical message. Because once, if you're patient and you're doing it the right way and you're building your scouting and player development in the right way and you're bringing in the right guys and you're developing in the right way, then over time, once you're better, you're more likely to stay better. And that's our hope.
You know, are there any parallels between the bond business and the baseball business? That are any things you brought over with you that are a little sense or things that you've been able to adapt?
There's a handful. I mean, obviously the bond business and the financial markets are very quantitative. A lot of what's happening in baseball today is what happened in the options markets. You know, just 20 years ago, there were a lot of kind of intuitive guys out there who fairly good with fractions and trading and fits, and they've all been replaced by, you know, basic guys who write algorithms and trade on their behalf. So, that market's changed. I think in baseball, you see the fact that what once was kind of a unique kind of side business is now a critical core competency for each and every team. And you have to be able to do that, otherwise you're falling behind. So that's a good parallel. The other one might be, in the bond markets, bonds are just a series of cash flows. Right, so it's a math problem in and of itself, right? But finding the right fit for people, giving them the right service, you know, treating your customers the right way is still critical. So, you know, there's always analytics, but they're only part of the solution.
On the analytics part, talk a little bit about this partnership with Bloomberg Sports. I mean, my sense is that you must have had a relationship with Bloomberg dating back decades from being in the Slayers business, right? So how does the partnership with Bloomberg Sports accelerate what you're trying to do?
Well, obviously, coming from the financial markets, I think Bloomberg is the standard. They handle trillions of dollars of, you know, in 163 countries every day in transactions with highest security requirements, everything. So obviously they have the ability to put together a good platform for you. But for us, what it came down to was, you know, over the years we underinvested in our technology platform, and we felt like we were pretty far behind. And you can say, well, let's start developing our own systems to answer our questions or address our issues. Or you can partner with someone who's already got a lot of that built and then tailor it to your needs. And we just thought from a kind of a time cost trade-off, it made a lot of sense to partner with someone who could build that platform. And they've been great partners so far, and I'm sure they'll be great partners going forward.
You talked about the human side, the personal side. During home games, there are known to walk through the stands and sign baseball cards. Tell us a little bit about how that gets started. What's that about?
Well, one of the things that we wanted to do from a family perspective is to be accessible. And you know, whether we're winning or losing, we want fans to know that we're with them, right? But it's true. I mean, I'm feeling their pain. You know? I mean, we're out there. So one of the things I did before the first season, I just on a whim, I said, why don't you print up 12 balls for every game with a date on them, versus Pirates, May 5th, 2010. And then I make sure I get out and hand those out to kids and just get out of it. And it's great because it's nice on a nice day when you want to go talk to people and you're winning. It's great to be out. You love talking to the fans and hanging out with baseball. But the fact that I have a dozen baseballs with that date printed on them and I can't let them go to waste gets me out of there when it's like 40 and drizzly. I think that the accessibility and getting out and talking to people has been pretty well received, and it's just who we are. So that's just part of the message we want to send to all of our fans. And we're with you. We're in the same boat.
That's great. You know, with some of the new changes in the new CBA, I'm thinking about those in the context of the way Theo likes to operate certain things, and certainly you're in the lead player development, the way you like to operate. In some ways, a lot of people believe that teams that are willing to spend resources and spend build that player development system quickly have been a bit hamstrung by new rules, and that they're now all bracketed in terms of what you can spend. Your thoughts on that? And obviously, you're, as an owner, you're involved in that process. Just your reaction to it?
Yeah, well, there's no question the CBA that we just signed, it's designed to take away some of the different strategies that other teams have used in the draft. And obviously, one of the strategies was to spend more money, you know, to take higher players, give them larger signing bonuses, and try to stockpile more talent than the other teams. I think that years ago, like some of the more progressive teams determined that the return on dollars spent on amateur players was higher than return on dollars spent on free agents, which is a pretty logical thing. So they were putting more resources into the draft. And not just big market teams. I mean, that's not just like the Red Sox, obviously other teams, smaller market teams were understanding that to be a better investment for them also. What the new CBA does is really takes that out of the play. You'll have a very well-defined number of dollars you can spend, and it'll definitely kind of compress the strategies. The other thing that changes is obviously the compensation picks are changing. A lot of teams were a little bit ahead of the curve and figuring out which guys were going to be Type D-free agents, bringing them in, getting that pick, keeping them for a year or half a year, and getting the pick at the end of the season. And so you go to the draft and you say, wait, how did the Rays get 7 picks? Because they were smart. They were understanding that, or the Red Sox too. You can say, well, how do they have 6 picks when we only have 4? They were smart and they were playing by the rules, but really, doing it in a way that was more thoughtful, right, than some other teams. So a lot of that's been taken out. But so what that does reinforce is back to scouting. those facts and making sure you have enough information to make the best decision you can on draft day. And obviously, it also puts more respect on player development. You're going to have fewer opportunities to develop those players so that impact players at the major league level. So you're going to have to make sure that you develop them in the right way. So it also goes internationally too. So I mean, it's a play. It really levels the playing field in a lot of ways.
On that very point, on the international side, recently outside of Central England, the Dominican Republic, you unveiled your new facility. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I think everybody in the room would understand that, you know, I forget the percentage, maybe 18% or something, of major league players are Latin American, Dominican, or Venezuelan, and certainly some of the best players are. And you sign players down there in kind of this free-for-all when they all turn 16. And then you develop them. So first of all, you want the best facility you can so that the players you bring in can develop optimally and develop as quickly as possible. But the other thing that occurred to us was if all the dollars that are going to get spent are being compressed and everybody only has the same or similar amount of dollars to spend, then a player's decision on which team he signs with could be more affected by the type of facility that's waiting for them than in the past. Maybe a player for $100,000 extra goes to the worst facility of the Dominican, but that $100,000 might be $10,000 now. And that might help us win some ties or near ties with those kind of players. So, and the third part of it is we just want to treat those guys as well as we can. You know, I often talk to fans and say, you know, it'd be really slow to judge some of these guys. You know, given some of the backgrounds they have, they just don't have the same kind of perspectives and the same kind of support system that we might have or American players might have. So, anyway, do everything we can to, you know, give them the opportunity to get GED equivalent type degrees, get them, you know, better in English before they go in the States, and have just a better facility for that. So, you know, it's the best way to train the players. I think it will give us an advantage in recruiting players at some point, and it's going to give us an advantage in how we treat the players. But it's expensive. It's a big investment. So, yeah.
Well, before we open it up to questions, I have one final question for you. And that is, tell us a little bit about your facility in Mesa. It's going to be
Yeah, well, the other thing that we walked right into right at the beginning of ownership was down here, particularly in the Cactus League, a lot of teams got new facilities. And our facilities have fallen way behind the industry standards. So we wanted to address that as quickly as possible and, you know, kind of dived right in on that project. And fortunately, with the support of the city of Mesa and the hard work of the mayor here and a few other folks, we were able to come to a deal where we're going to build a new facility just for the north of here. That will, you know, it'll bring us up to standard and maybe, you know, above average type of training facilities with a new ballpark plan. And that's critical too. I mean, you can't tell everybody in your organization you're trying to build the best organization in baseball and then send them to the worst facilities in Texas. So we're addressing that. I think that's a long-term benefit too. It'll help us. And it's also very consistent with our message that it's about their development. So I think, you know, it's going to take a few years. A lot of investors, a couple fans in here, everyone has to know we're investing in the future. We're building the platform with, you know, great facilities, obviously great leadership in baseball, and we're going to bring in the right kids to take advantage of that, baseball minds and take advantage of that.
I'd like to open it up to questions.
Well, I was kind of curious to know whatever became of the hot dog vendor that caught you throwing the hot dogs in the garbage on your current boss.
He's still gainfully employed. Okay. No, we're talking about the undercover boss episode. It was actually my brother that went undercover that week. But it's a really funny story because my brother was selling these hot dogs and it was toward like the fifth or sixth inning and he's like, these are cold, my sterno's out. I mean, nobody's going to want these hot dogs. So he's like, so he takes $20 out of his own pocket, throws it in the cash for the hot dog, throws the hot dogs in the garbage. Well, somebody tells the vendor who had stepped away, that they just saw this guy throw hot dogs in the garbage. And he comes over and snaps because he thinks he's out for 20 bucks. So then they take him down to the commissary where they buy the hot dogs. So if you don't sell your hot dogs, you get your money refunded. So he's going to go down and show my brother that you cost me 20 bucks. But they told the lady at the commissary what was happening. And he goes, all right, here's the hot dogs. I want my $20 back. And she goes, those aren't our hot dogs. Like, what do you mean they're not your hot dogs? Like, you must have bought those at a stand. I didn't buy these at a stand. I got these here. And he started to freak out. So they didn't put that in the show. But anyway, it was pretty funny. And obviously when Rocco, the guy, got in on the joke.
I'm kind of curious, do you use analytics in any possible way for the vending at the stadium itself to move more product, to reduce lines, things like that?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, we partner with Levy, and they have a lot of those kind of metrics and analysis. We also have consultants that help us on preparation and food mix. So there are some analytics. I'm not as close to them, as some of the guys that are doing it, but there are some, yeah.
Tom, where does the refurbishment of Wrigley Field stand at this point?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, obviously Wrigley Field was built in 1914, and the owners historically both contributed to the Wrigley's, at least the last part of the Wrigley's. They didn't really put much money into the park, so it needs some help. It needs help to be preserved for the next generation, and it needs help to provide better fan experience. I think that most people agree that once you get to your seat at Wrigley, you think you're the greatest place on earth. And then when you get up and you go back to the concourse, it's just not up to the standard of what other parks are today. So we're working with our elected officials on trying to figure out solutions that'll work. I think everyone's got the best intention at the moment. We haven't quite isolated the exact solution yet, but we're working on it, and hopefully at some point in the future we'll have something that really helps us, gives us the flexibility to really make really work and save it for the next generation.
As a Pirates fan, I looked at the ability of the team to spend a lot of money on the draft as a method of leveling the playing field with other teams like the Red Sox or the Yankees who can spend on the major league free agents. So, for $15 million a year where you might get a couple of middling major leaguers, you could get maybe two blue chip prospects. I don't necessarily have a problem with a draft budget, but once the details came out, to me it seemed like it was too small. Where the Pirates, say, the previous 2 years had spent a total of $15 million, been able to sign two or three really good prospects. Now they're drafting eighth, but they only get $5 million. And I thought maybe if, number one team gets 15, by the time you get down to number 10, maybe you're at $10 million, that it would still be, the dollars might be more in line with what it was before, but, I see $5 million as pretty crippling of the strategy that they had.
Well, as I mentioned, it wasn't just big market teams that put more resources into the average draft. Pirates were among the top spenders over the last few years, and I think, I've harassed them, and I don't really know them, but I'm sure what they did was decide that was a better use for the dollars. And so whether you're the Red Sox or the Pirates, that's kind of taken away too. I think the other point that you can make in there is, if you can only spend a certain amount on those top picks, do some of those top picks go to college? Or decide to stay in school longer? I don't know. But it certainly does. It certainly will have an impact on some of those decisions, both for the team.
I have had the pleasure to see a lot of the Cubs spring training games, and the difference between the players I see this year and the players I saw last year, a lot fewer mental errors out there. It just seems to be a lot crisper baseball being played this year. It looks like a lot of the drills that your management staff has gone through has started to pay off. Do you agree with that?
You know, the I agree that I think that the hard work that our coaches and our manager are putting in now is paying off. I mean, Dale's very clear that, hey, there's something we can control in this game. We're going to control the money. We're, you know, we can't control, you know, whether or not we can hit some guy's fastball all the time or curveball, whatever, but we can't control how we run the bases. We can control how we get the cutoff command. We can control how we prepare for games. So I think that that message is being heard by the players. I know they're working harder than they have in years past, and I know the energy and the attitude is terrific. So you know, the I think we're going to have a great season. I think fans are coming to Wrigley, and they can expect a team that's going to be really well prepared. They can expect a team that's going to play very hard, and a team that comes to compete every day. So I think that that's a reflection on Dale and his philosophy and his determination.
Other questions? Yes.
Hello, my name is Steven. I'm a senior at NYU. And my question is about you as an owner. So obviously as an owner, you want to get involved with the baseball side, but at the same time, you need to take some more step back and let your people do their job. So how do you keep yourself from getting too involved, but also at the same time, what kind of analytics are you looking at in terms of the baseball side, and what do you place more of that on?
Yeah, that's a good question. Like, there's always that fan in you who wants to, like, jump in there, but you have to fight that urge. I mean, ultimately, in any business, anywhere you're holding anyone accountable for the results, you can't insert yourself and let them, you know, you just can't let them off the hook to be like, look, the fact is that we hire great people for a reason. They're going to make good decisions. I'm going to support all those decisions, and we're going to take a look at the results a handful of years from now to see if those decisions pay off. But, you know, once again, like, as a fan, it's tough. You get a weak moment, you're like,
how come you can't afford to hold school season?
You know, like, you know, you have your weak moments, no doubt. But in terms of analytics, you know, and Ari's here in the front row. He's my go-to guy on this stuff. Like, you know, I try to stay up on some of it. You know, I have my fan graphs on my iPhone app, and you know, so I look at that stuff. But you know, it's ultimately it's not where I'm adding value. You know, my value add is by hiring the right people and giving them the support. And then doing everything I can to, you know, improve the stadium and do more for the community. So, but it is unique. But you have to stay out of those things.
Any other questions? Well, great. Well, thank you, Tom.
I'm trying to get up there. What's that?